Audi.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast, sponsored by WeCure. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Just so you know, WeCure arranged for people to have medical and aesthetic treatments abroad in a beautiful and internationally acclaimed clinic in Turkey. And we have a special offer for anyone who visits the Big Travel Podcast page on their website. The offer means that if you book anything with them, you can take a friend with you absolutely free with all expenses paid for them. So you get a little holiday with someone you like, as well as getting your teeth or your hair or whatever else you need done. Go to wecure.co.uk/bigtravelpodcast and please spread the word. That's wecure.co.uk/bigtravelpodcast. Well, I've had a busy time this week with the news of the UK putting anyone coming in or back from Spain to the UK into quarantine. First they said it was 14 days, now they've said it was 10 days, but the news was changing all the time. It was changing per every half hour at one point. I was on the Foreign Office website. I was on 15 different radio stations. I was on BBC Breakfast News on the television and Channel 5 News as well. And it's been a little bit crazy. I have to say, I am here in Spain and, it feels absolutely fine. They say there's been spikes, but Spain is a big country. There's 45 odd million people here. It's very big. And the spike has been in places that are far away from here, the Costa del Sol and the Costa Brava. And here's where the tourists are likely to be. And, I'm not a scientist. I'm a travel journalist, but I do think that it's just too much. It's too much. We shouldn't have put the whole country onto quarantine. It should be more localized than that. But what do I know? I'm a travel journalist, not a scientist. So, I really hope that the most important thing that everyone is safe and healthy. And that goes with not getting corona and also keeping the economy open and that sort of thing, and making sure people can healthily and safely visit loved ones and travel if that's what you want to do. So on to today's guest, shall we? After an influential secondary school teacher took him to communist Russia, Ian Dale was hooked on travel. He's since lived in Germany, had to run away from a Hungarian prostitute. He's been guarded at gunpoint in Beirut, done things he doesn't feel he can tell us in a Miami hotel, and feels that Washington, D.C. is almost an ancestral home. With conversations about this and his brilliant new book about angry tweeters, the decline of social discourse, and why can't we all get along, it's LBC presenter, author, political commentator, panelist, and much more, Ian Dale.
Why don't you start off by telling me about your new book?
The new book is called Why Can't We Get Along? Shout Less, Listen More. And it's all about the decline of public discourse, whether it's on social media, in political debate, just in normal society, looking at why it's happened and what can be done about it. And I guess I decided to write it because I've just got so frustrated with the way that people conduct themselves, particularly on social media, where you have the slightest disagreement and someone calls you a twat. And so your natural human reaction is to respond and say, you effing twat, and then it escalates from there. And this is the sort of thing that normally wouldn't happen when people speak face to face. And there are so many things that happen on social media that just wouldn't happen in normal conversation. And it just leads to unnecessary aggression. And this is reflected in the political debate. You go on TV programmes now like Question Time, and people just call each other liars to their faces, which would never have happened in the programme's heyday. So I look at lots of examples of this, and I'll be quite honest, I've been as guilty as anyone indulging in this. But there comes a moment when you really do have to stop and think this far and no more.
Do you think that it's actually reflecting how our personalities are in normal life? Because you have this cloak of anonymity when you're on the internet, and people, I feel, might have become more free in the way of expressing their anger, and now they're, you know, that anger is translating into our face-to-face interactions.
Well, I think it has stemmed from, I mean, anonymity is a really important contributor to it, but I think it's also stemmed from the various political crises that we found ourselves in over the last 10 or 20 years. And people have got very frustrated with their politicians, so they feel that the way to hold them to account is to shout at them. Now, if you're a politician, that's obviously not a particularly nice place to be. And I think most politicians think they are in touch with public opinion because of the number of people they meet day to day in their constituencies. But a lot of people think they've been lied to. They think the mainstream media is lying to them. And you've got these silos now, echo chambers that people live in, where people will say, when Nigel Farage left LBC, people say, oh, well, I'm not going to listen to LBC anymore. It's clearly a lefty station. Well, hang on a minute. Look at who the other presenters or some of the other presenters are as well. And people are starting to think, well, I'm not going to listen to people I don't agree with. Well, if you're in the field of debate, which I'm in most of the time, you need to understand people who think differently to you, who hold different views, because if you don't understand their point of view, how can you debate against them? That's a basic of learning how to debate people, whereas most people now, it seems, particularly on social media, think the way to debate is to insult and shout.
And it's making us very, as well as very angry, I think it's making people very anxious as well, because, you know, we had the whole, everyone feels very divided. We had the whole Brexit thing that made us all a bit anxious, no matter what side you were on and fell out. And now we've got the COVID thing, and you've got people's, you know, the stay at home people, the people that are getting very angry. You've got the people that are going out and protesting and, you know, having their big parties and everything. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like the divisions are getting deeper and deeper, and online or social media, and being able to comment and, like you said, have that cloak anonymity is really making it 10 times worse.
And you've also got the virtual disappearance of deference. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I don't want a four-log tucking society. But the internet has democratised everything, which I thought initially was a really good thing because it gave Mrs. Miggins at 32 Acacia Avenue a voice. But unfortunately, that voice has been used to negative effects a lot of the time and in a very aggressive way. And it's, I mean, I don't suffer from mental health conditions, but I'll tell you what, if I did, I don't think I would be on Twitter now, because you can get so, it is addictive. You can get so obsessed by what people are saying about you, particularly if you have a bit of a public profile and you adopt positions that inevitably some people are going to find controversial. Twitter can be a very nasty place. There are often times when I'd go to tweet something and then I think to myself, do I really want the 2 days of absolute hell that I'm going to get if I tweet this? And it's becoming increasingly, I mean, these occasions happen when it's just something almost completely normal. But you think, well, if I do that, I'm going to have all the sort of woke, politically correct, snowflakey brigade on my back. Do I really want that for the next 2 days? Because there are times when you actually literally can't look at your Twitter feed because it is just so full of personal abuse.
And that's where the bubble, it becomes so key, doesn't it, in a negative and a positive way? Because you're a public figure, so, you know, you've got all sorts of people following you. But if you surround yourself with the bubble and you switch off the people who you don't believe in or who make you angry, because they do have that physical effect on people, they make them angry and, you know, and like you said, affect mental health. But if you do switch that off, then you're in danger of, you know, everything around you being an opinion that is one you agree with. And then you don't really, you know, that's how we've got into the Trump mess, I think, is that people didn't see that was coming, but the people who supported him absolutely saw that was coming.
Well, I think there are people like Owen Jones, for example, the left-wing commentator who I used to follow on Twitter, have been very friendly with over the years. But I know that if I ever mention him on Twitter, whether I at him in it or whether I just write his name, the absolute abuse he gets is awful. Now, he brings it on himself to a large degree because of some of the things that he says, but nobody can justify a lot of the abuse that he gets. So I don't follow him on Twitter anymore for that reason. That I just think, well, if I ever go into a debate with him, it's going to be his supporters swarming down on me, my supporters swarming down on him, and the only two that lose out are him and me. So I just don't engage anymore, which is not how it should be.
It's funny you should mention that, because this is going down a bit of a rabbit hole, and I'll get onto the travel in a minute. But I worry about Owen Jones, because he comes out with these such strong opinions. And most of the time, you know, I am a left-leaning person. Most of the time, I'm, you know, okay with what he says. But I look at him and think, I worry about you, Owen. I kind of want to give you a cuddle, you know, because there is that much abuse out there. And he's still very brave and, you know, pushing ahead with his opinions regardless. And you have to think, when you're alone in your home and you're sitting there with all this online abuse, you know, think of, say, Caroline Flack, for example. You have to wonder what that does to a person. You need to be very tough-skinned for it, don't you?
You absolutely do. And most people aren't tough-skinned, however much they might like to think they are. And I used to sometimes just retweet insults from so-called ordinary people, just to sort of make them think again, to make them think, well, should I have really done that? Wasn't that a bit over the top? And often they would apologise. However, what I've found is that if I then retweet something or even quote tweet it, saying something that might ridicule what they've said, I have an army of people, which I didn't really realise I had, that then go into bat on my behalf without me actually asking them to, but they just do. So they swarm on this sometimes perfectly innocent person, and that can be a pretty traumatic experience if you're not used to it. So I'm very careful now if I do that.
And this is how it should be. Like, you and I are politically from different spectrums. However, when I listen to you on LBC, I'm not shouting at the radio, because you're not a shock jock, if we're still using that term. You're actually just having a decent debate about it. And that is really exactly how it should be.
Yeah, I mean, debate is everything. You just have to accept that there is another point of view. People are perfectly entitled to hold another point of view. And if you disagree with it, then argue with them. But it doesn't have to be done in a nasty way. And that's kind of the whole message of the book. And it's not a sort of Pollyanna book. I do address some quite controversial things in it. And it is, there's a bit of autobiography in it. I'm using examples that I've been involved in, some of which do not reflect well on me, it has to be said. But I hope it just maybe starts a proper debate about the future of our public discourse. It's out at the beginning of August.
Now, autobiography is very much what we're about in this, well, biography, I guess, rather than autobiography, although I do talk about, witter on about myself quite a lot as well, very much about with this podcast. And it's all about life stories through travel. I know you are a very well-travelled person. Not are you only a very well-travelled person, you're also a very well-organised person, as I can see from your political writings, but also the fact that you're actually the most organised guest I've ever had on.
Oh,
and
really?
You listened to the podcast and you suggested a list of talking points. I mean, that's amazing. A lot of people just rock up and go like, who are you? What are we talking about? Oh yeah, I can wing that. So I actually have, instead of asking you random questions to actually, you know, try and draw out things, I've got a list of wonderful travel points, it sounds like. And I'm going to start with the first, which takes us all the way back to 1969, I believe.
That was the first time that I ventured away from the shores. I was 7 years old. We were staying at the Ivyside Hotel in Westgate-on-Sea in Kent. And it was the only family holiday that we ever went on, because my dad was a farmer. And the last thing any farmer does in the summer is go on holiday. And we had pigs and cows, so they all had to be looked after. So his brother-in-law came and did that. And bizarrely, thinking of my dad, how I grew to know what he was like as an adult, he said, well, let's go on a day trip to Boulogne on the North French coast. So off we travelled on a hovercraft, which obviously don't really exist anymore. That was an adventure. And the fact that I even remember it all tells you that it was a really memorable trip. It was only for the day. I remember sitting in a park and a French lady coming up to us and talking to us in English and wanted to know all about us. And it was, I suppose, at that point that I thought, oh, I'd quite like to do a bit more of this. And although you describe me as well-travelled, I mean, I have been to a reasonable number of places, but I don't think I am that well-travelled. There are large parts of the world that I've never been to, would love to go to. But unfortunately, I'm married to someone who hates going on holiday, which kind of restricts my movement to an extent.
What are his reasons for hating going on holiday? And can you just go without him? That would be my preferred option.
I actually like travelling on my own. And I have been away by myself. Before I met him, I would always go away by myself. But he always wants to come back early whenever we go away. We went on a 10-day trip to Cape Cod. This was in 2001. And we came back 3 days early. In fact, we flew on one of the flights that 3 weeks later was involved in 9/11, which was quite a thought. I looked up the flight number that we're on when it happened, and we flew on the flight from Boston to, was it New York or Washington? I can't remember. But
well, that's going to help with his love of not travelling.
Well, exactly.
Isn't it?
doesn't like going on planes at the best of times. We went on a week or 2 weeks to Crete about 7 or 8 years ago, and I quite enjoyed it. We had a sort of our own villa with its own little swimming pool. He's just a home person, just loves being at home and thinks, well, we've got a holiday home in Norfolk. Why would we go anywhere else?
The home people have really been winning in the COVID times, haven't they? They really have. And, you know, I'm the sort of person who closes the door on the house and the mess and just gets out as often as possible, hopefully abroad, but if not to like a near
just
town
as well
or
with
even
your
across
job.
The... Yeah, exactly. Across the other side of London. I mean, I'm desperate to get out of the borough right now, let alone, you know, anywhere, you know, Australia or anything. But the home people have really won in this situation, yeah. Haven't they? They've been totally unaffected in many ways.
Absolutely. And I've enjoyed it, actually. I haven't been out of my house for more than 100 days now. In fact, I think it's about 110 because I'm a type 2 diabetic. So I've been shielding. And I thought I wouldn't like it at all. But it's given me the opportunity to do a lot of things around the house that I haven't done for years, apart from tidying up, obviously. And yeah, it's not been bad. But I mean, if I lived in central London in a studio flat, I think I would have been driven mad by now.
I know people that have been at home with children in flats and it sounds hideous and I've been so grateful for the garden, but you actually haven't been out the house for 100 days. Have you been to the shop or anything like that? Or
I've been to the corner shop about 400 yards away to take Hermes parcels because I started a little sideline selling political mugs.
Have
which
you?
Which has proved to be rather popular. So,
what do they say, these mugs?
Oh, there's a Boris Johnson mug, Get Breakfast Done.
Ha ha, I see what you did there.
Yeah, exactly. Jeremy Corbyn, For the Many, Not the Brew.
I
so
like
all
it.
Sorts of things like that. Margaret Thatcher mugs, Lady T, get it?
I do.
And they've sold rather better than I thought they would. So I've been, and I pack them all myself. So it's been quite therapeutic in some ways. But so I take them up to the Hermes shop maybe a couple of times a week. But that is literally the only place that I've been over the last, ever since the 17th of March.
It's going to be so weird when you actually get out there again. You're either going to be like a little bit scared or going to be like a convent schoolgirl released, you know, when they're 18 to like the real world.
I've
and go, hey,
always wanted to be a convent schoolgirl. I think you're right. I think that the first day when I have to go into London, into Leicester Square to LBC, and I step on that train at Tunbridge Station, I think I'm going to feel quite nervous. And I'm not an anxious person, but I think it is going to feel very weird. And obviously, I have to wear a face mask, which I've never worn before. And I mean, there is part of me that does want to go back, but I'm not going to go back until the beginning of August when shielding officially stops. And if there are lots
of... Who knows what's happening then?
Well, exactly. If there are lots of spikes after then I may not do that.
Funny you should mention the mugs. They sound great, but I was going to... tell you, I'm actually drinking out of my Talk Sport mug here.
Oh,
I'm
dear.
Sorry. I know. But I was their first ever female presenter and used to co-present the Late Night Show with Ian Collins. And,
did you?
So I've got this Talk Sport mug that I stole from... They didn't even give me one of them.
He's
I stole
a very good
it.
Friend.
Oh, really? Oh, he's lovely, Ian. Well, actually, we used to fall out a lot politically. I think that's probably why he got
that's,
me.
Yeah, that's not a great surprise. I think I need to send you one of my Keep Calm and Listen to Ian Dale mugs.
You do, you absolutely do, definitely. So back to the travel.
Yep.
Your first, well, I don't know if it was your first school trip, but as I have your handy list, you went to Moscow on a school trip. Is that right?
I did. It was Moscow and Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as it is now, obviously. The head of languages at the school, David Lewis, who probably, of all my teachers, had more influence on me than any other, he was a great organiser of school trips. And my memory is that this trip cost my parents £130, and it was a 10-day trip. And I took £14 in spending money, can you believe, and came back with seven. And of course, it was the height of the power of the Soviet Union. It was an amazing trip. It started in Leningrad, and it was in April. So you had ice chunks flowing down the River Neva. We had official Soviet guides who would obviously convince us that everything about the Soviet Union was better than anywhere else. And they had the biggest, the longest, the highest of everything. And I remember going to the Hermitage, the art museum and gallery, and they told us it would take, I think, 70 days or 700 days to actually go round the whole thing. And I remember being really impressed by Leningrad. It was a really impressive city. And I suppose it was the first time that I'd been abroad to a major city. And then we had to take an overnight train to Moscow. And Moscow in those days was not the Moscow that it is now. If you go to Moscow nowadays, and I went back in about 2011, it's a bit like an American city, particularly when you drive from the airport. There were these huge advertising hoardings along the side of the freeway. And there was a part of me that thought, you know, I actually preferred it under communism. But the centre of Moscow is just beautiful, particularly, obviously, the Red Square, St. Basil's Cathedral. And then we went in to see Lenin's corpse, which was a bit weird. And it was the most amazing experience for someone who was only 13.
Well, you went to a particularly progressive school. That's quite a different trip, isn't it? It's not like, you know, a week in France as everyone else.
No, I don't know about progressive. It was just I happened to have lucked out in having David Lewis as the head of languages, because if the teachers don't organise the trips, they don't happen. And I really feel sorry for kids nowadays, because I'm not sure that a lot of them get those, because we didn't have all the health and safety risk assessments, none of that in those days. And he then took me on two school exchanges to Germany, because I'd started learning German, ended up doing my degree in German, partly as a result of these trips. And that kind of changed my life, gave me a completely different outlook on things. And I was terrible at German when I first started it, but I came back from this first school trip. It was a 3-week exchange to a town called Bad Wildungen in Hessen in Germany. And I came top of the class in German. And my teacher thought I must have cheated in the end of year exams. And eventually worked out that I hadn't. And this has always stuck in my mind. I said something in German to him in the middle of a class, and he said, "Why did you say it that way?" And I said, "I've got no clue," thinking that he would then have a go at me. And he said, "Well, that's brilliant, because that's the first road to fluency. When you don't know why you say something, but you say it right, you start becoming fluent." And I did become fluent in German. I spent a gap year there. I spent another year there as part of my degree. And Germans could not tell that I was English. I was that fluent.
That's incredible. Do you think that first exposure to foreignness, because, you know, Russia at that point was particularly foreign. I mean, it is in a lot of parts now. And I know foreign is a, you know, not the right word to me, but to use, but it's, you know, particularly different and other compared to someone who's coming from the UK at that time. Do you think that early exposure sort of influenced that flair for languages, or you just happened to be good at them naturally?
I'm not sure I did have a flair for languages. I had a flair for German, but I was totally useless at French. I mean, the only reason I started learning German was because you had to have a quota from each class in the year group to learn German. I had terrible French teachers, but they had to nominate somebody, so I got nominated. I wasn't going to do it, but my grandmother, who was a huge influence on me in the 1970s, she said, "Well, what have you got to lose? If you don't like it, you can stop doing it, but you never know what might come of it." And boy, was she right, because if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have studied German at the University of East Anglia. I wouldn't have got involved in politics. That was a real sort of one of those sliding doors moments where I made a choice, and it's kind of guided my life ever since, even though in my professional career I've never done a job which really utilised German.
I think it's one of those things that learning a language, though, because I accidentally learned a language because I moved to Spain at the age of 7, so I didn't plan to learn a language. We just, you know, luckily it was a side effect of moving to Spain, although we were in an expat community, so not everyone learnt it. But I think almost it's like, and going back to politics a little bit, it's almost like when you go to university, and I'm the first person in my family to go to university, so we weren't a university. Oh, that's good. We weren't a university family, you know. But I think going to university, and along with learning a language, gives you something of an edge when it comes to critical thinking. And I'm not sure that that's taught anymore, you know, to talk to see the other side of the coin, you know, to debate the side that you don't agree with, to speak a language and go to somewhere where you know you're immersed in another culture. And I don't know why I'm equating those two, the language learning and the critical thinking, but I think it is something about broad learning that helps you see that things from different angles. And that sort of ties in back to what we were talking about in relation to your book, being able to see other people's point of view. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think that there is a point in that. I was very careful in the university that I chose because I didn't want to study German literature. I just couldn't stand all the critics of you read a book and then people say, well, what do you think that character meant by doing that? And you have to come out with all these high-flown theories, which you don't really believe. You think, well, he did that because that's the character, yeah. And that's why he did it. So I didn't want to do literature. I wanted to concentrate on the linguistic side. So I found a course at UEA, then known as the University of Easy Access, not so much now. Because my life had been kind of mapped out for me. I was from a farming background, and I should have gone to agricultural college. But I was totally useless at sciences. And my parents, to their credit, because my wider family, I don't think would have reacted like this, they never put pressure on me. And I knew from the age of 7 that I wasn't going to be a farmer. And it must have been a real disappointment for my parents, but they backed me in everything I did. And when I said I wanted to study German at UEA, they couldn't have been more supportive. But doing the course that I did, which was German language, German linguistics, teaching English as a foreign language, and there was sort of the odd history module, sort of Austria, East Germany, West German history, modern history. You're right, it did, particularly the linguistic side, which I found incredibly difficult because it's actually more of a science than an art. That did, I think, enable me to think differently about things and to argue in a more convincing way. And, of course, getting involved in politics at university as well.
I'm going to stop talking about Germany a minute and move on to Italy. However, just before that, I wanted to know whether you've read the book Travellers in the Third Reich.
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
So good. And what made me think of it was because Germany used to have more importance to us as a place of travel. It was almost like... sort of upper middle class people used to go there almost as a grand tour, and up until the point in between the wars and probably afterwards, but more sort of dwindling as we discovered sort of Italy and France and Spain as package holiday destinations. People were travelling there and learning German. I remember my granddad, who was not a scholar, but not a university, we're working class originally, family, he learnt German. German and Germany had this sort of greater importance, I feel, than it has in our lives now. I don't know if people learn it at school.
I think the number of people learning German has declined exponentially over the last 20 years, not just in schools, but also universities. Languages aren't as important to us, and they ought to be. I remember in 2004, I went on my first demonstration at UEA when they closed the languages department down, and I thought it's outrageous that modern-day students didn't have the opportunities that I had, particularly when, I mean, Norwich is about as near as a university to Scandinavia that you can get. And they used to have Norwegian courses, Swedish courses, Finnish courses. They don't exist anywhere. And it's a crying shame that language teaching in schools has declined in the way that it has. And we can't just trust the fact that everybody else speaks our language. That's what lies behind it, I think. Now, I'm not saying everyone should learn German, but you look at the coming languages, Arabic, Mandarin, Spanish. Those are the languages which ought to be taught in schools. And they are taught in some schools, but not enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's when you're young, isn't it, that you need to learn it? Because I don't think I could be asked, to be honest, to go out and learn a new language now. So it's absolutely the schools and even those school trips are so important.
Well,
now, I'm going to move on.
Just on that, yeah. The optimum age to learn a new language, do you know what it is?
I have no idea.
7. And yet we don't actually start generally until maybe the year before we go to secondary school. So in my view, we ought to be learning a language properly as soon as we start primary school. But I mean, I don't think that will ever happen.
Well, I was 7 when I moved to Spain and actually never ended up. I don't speak Spanish like a Spanish person because we were in an English community and I moved away when I was 16 and been travelling and living in the UK ever since. But you know, I am a fluent Spanish speaker. Everyone else would think I'm a fluent Spanish speaker, but speaker. So we're going to move on to Italy with my handy list here as my most organised guest ever. You went on a trip around Italy on a Cosmos coach trip in 1980, which sounds, in my head, I'm visualising it. I'm visualising the fashion, you know, the music, the disasters that can come out of that.
There were six of us from my sixth form class who we decided when we'd done A-levels we all wanted to go on a sort of last hurrah, and we spent hours planning a road trip which would start at the hook of Holland. We'd drive up around Scandinavia, down through Germany, Switzerland, Austria, going to Italy, up through France. But my dad had a Wolseley 6 at that point, made by British Leyland, which was rather unreliable. And I thought, well, there aren't going to be many Wolseley dealers around Europe. So in the end, we decided to go on a package holiday, which, given that we were all 17 or 18, you think, well, that's a bit of an odd thing to do, given most of the other people were either middle-aged or old. But it was fantastic. It really was. It was 14 days around Italy. 7 days of those were in Sorrento, but we went to Venice, Florence, Rome, and then sort of all along the Amalfi Coast, went to Capri. And I just fell in love with Italy. And I don't feel that I've been back enough. I haven't been back to Rome since, even though I would still say it was one of the top three places I've ever been to. And it wasn't actually weird being with a lot of older people. I think they quite liked the fact that there was a group of youngsters on the holiday as well. And we certainly had a fantastic time. And I think that I've never been on a coach holiday since, partly because I'm 6'2" and I just don't think it would work. But it really did, I suppose. I think that was the first time when I thought, I really want to do a lot more travelling. And throughout the 1980s and 1990s, I did. I mean, mainly to the United States, it has to be said. I first went to the United States in 87 and went back two or three times a year for the next probably 15 years.
What you said about coach travel is that it can be a bit uncomfortable, probably more when you're over 6 foot, but overland travel is certainly something that people are considering more of, because of the whole issue with flights and everything and slow travel and that sort of thing. And I find that you do see a lot more when you travel overland, but you have to have the luxury of time, don't you? And not many of us have the luxury of time.
Well, you do, and you can only really stop when everybody else stops. I mean, that you don't make on the spur of the moment. You might see something out the car window and you can just drive there. You can't do that on a coach. So I like the freedom of having a rental car wherever I am, rather than necessarily going on something that's organised. But on the other hand, my friend Jackie Smith, who I do the For the Many podcast with, she went on a 2-week trip to, or was it 10 days, to India earlier this year, just before lockdown. And that was all organised. Literally every minute of the day was organised. And she said she thought she might not like that, but I think she absolutely loved it in the end. Sometimes it's nice for people to do all the thinking for you.
India can be hard work, you know, and it's quite nice for someone to take a bit of that off, the pressure off. Now, you were guarded by the SAS in Beirut in 1991. What's that about?
Well, I was running a transport public affairs consultancy, and we got a call one day from the Department of Transport saying, we've got this opportunity to speak at a transport privatisation conference in Beirut, but unfortunately, there's nobody available in the department. We wondered if you might like to go. And I thought to myself, and bear in mind, this was only about 2 months after John McCarthy had been released as a hostage. I thought, I wonder why there's no one available in the Department of Transport to go. But there's always been a bit of a daredevil about me. And I thought, if I don't do this, I may well regret it. It'll be such an opportunity to see something new. So, I mean, I could speak for the rest of the podcast about this trip, but I'll cut it short. So, got a first-class flight on Middle Eastern Airlines, arrive at Beirut Airport. The aircraft is surrounded by gun-toting Lebanese soldiers. And I had been told by the Foreign Office that I must only meet their representatives at the airport. I was not to talk to anyone else. Anyway, I go to get off the plane, and there's steps down to the tarmac, and a huge black Mercedes draws up. And so I get down to the bottom. He says, "Mr. Dale?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You'll come with me." I said, no, I've got to wait for someone from the British Foreign Office. "Mr. Dale, you come with me." So that was a bit frightening. So they took me to this shack to do all of the paperwork to let me into the country. We went into the airport terminal and I sat down thinking, well, what happens now? And eventually about seven British soldiers turn up in full khaki gear. And they said, right, we're taking you to your hotel. So off we go in armed Land Rovers, an advanced one, and then me and the one behind. Two of them have machine guns pointing out of the doors, and they say, right, we're just going through the most dangerous bit now, where all the kidnaps occur. I think, okay, right. So we get to the hotel, and they say, right, do you want to go and change? And I said, what for? Well, you're guest of honour at the British Embassy tonight. And bear in mind, at that point, I was, 28 years old? I said, guest of honour, what for? Oh, the ambassador's having a reception for you because you're the first person to visit Lebanon since John McCarthy was released.
No, seriously.
And I was thinking, oh my God. And I had no sort of posh clothes, really. Anyway, so we went on a trip with these two Land Rovers through the centre of Beirut. And I did think it might not be a particularly good idea to have the Union Jack flying on a little flag on the bonnet of one of the Land Rovers, but there we go. So we saw all of the ruins, and Beirut was literally a ruin at that point. And we get to the embassy. And there's a sort of chicane, so people couldn't go and bomb it. And I walk in the door, and the ambassador comes to greet me, and says, "Right, would you like a drink? And then we'll sit down to dinner." And everyone's really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. And I'm thinking,
no.
"What?
What do I have to say?"
So I had to make a completely—I can't remember what I spoke about, but I had to make an off-the-cuff speech. So then I went and spoke at this privatization conference the next day, which I then learned was broadcast all over the Middle East, and. The next day I had free, and one of the guys organising the conference said, would you like to go on a trip on the outskirts of Beirut, go through the Bekaa Valley? And of course I'd been told not to go anywhere without the SAS. So of course I said, yeah, I'd love to. So he got taken by this trip, and he took me to meet his family, spent most of the day doing that. And then the next day, I think I had half a day free before I came back, and I thought, well, I need to get some sort of souvenirs. So I said to the driver, who only spoke French, can we go into the centre of Beirut so I can buy a few things? So there was I walking down downtown Beirut in my three-piece suit, sticking out like a sore thumb. And I did think, I'm not sure this was the wisest thing to do. But anyway, I got out alive and it was a fantastic experience.
I love that. When you go away, it's like, you know you're in for a good holiday when they tell you don't go anywhere without the SAS.
Yeah, quite.
I had Dom Jolly on the podcast a few months ago, and he has some incredible stories about growing up in Beirut. And John McCarthy stayed at his family house the night before he disappeared.
Really?
Yeah, you should speak to him about it. He's got some really
interesting
stories.
I will, because I know he listens to my programme, so I'll have him on.
Oh, good. I was going to say he'd be listening, but actually we're not on your programme, we're on my programme. I'm very confused as to where I am right now, and I'm meant to be running this show. But he also used to take back souvenirs as souvenirs to his boarding school in Oxford. So yeah. Did you actually find a souvenir in the centre of Beirut at that point?
I did buy a few little trinkets, but I can't remember what they were.
I'd love to get hold of that recording of your speech. It must be available somewhere. So talking of conflict, you were in, well, the end of conflict, I guess. You were in Budapest as the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah, I've got an American friend, Mark Milosh, who I met. He came when I worked in the House of Commons in the mid-1980s. He was an intern. And, I mean, we've remained friends ever since. And he came over. This would have been, I think, at the probably March 1990. And it could be 91. No, I think it was, anyway, around then. And we went on a road trip. I had a VW Scirocco at the time, and we ended up in Vienna, which I expected to really like Vienna. But in sort of the end of winter, beginning of spring, Vienna's always a bit dirty. And so we didn't stay there as long as we thought we would. So we were looking at the map thinking, well, where should we go next? And I said, well, what about, let's go to the Hungarian border and see what that's like. So we drove to the Hungarian border. I then talked to some of the Austrian border guards and I said, well, presumably we're not allowed to go through. And he said, oh, yes, you absolutely can. And then I thought, well, let's go for 2 hours because my car wasn't insured to drive in Hungary. But of course, 2 hours then became 2 days. So we, instead of just going over the border to say that we've been to Hungary, we drove to Budapest, which it was really in the Western influence was starting. The first McDonald's was being built while we were there. So I'm really glad that I went when it hadn't become Westernized. And it was a most amazing place. Anybody that wants a good city break in Central Europe, go to Budapest. It's the architecture is fantastic. The people, well, certainly at that point were fantastic, and I'm sure they still are. And the food was to die for. So we spent a couple of days there, then drove back to the Austrian border, and we stopped before we got there. We were going to spend the night there. We couldn't find a hotel, and we were just sitting in our car looking at a map, and this woman came over and said, "Are you looking for somewhere to stay?" And we said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, my grandmother's got a room. Would you like to have a look?" So she walked us up to her grandmother's house, sort of arm in arm, which I did think was a little bit weird, but and didn't think anything of it. She showed us the room, so we said, "Yeah, that's fine." So I said, we'll go and get our things, and we're just going to have a meal at the hotel down there. So she said, "Oh, I'll come with you." And again, I thought, that's a little bit odd. So we sat down and started chatting away, and then Mark said, "Oh, I'm just going to pop to the loo." Anyway, he didn't come back. So eventually I said to her, "I better find out what's happened to Mark." So I went to look for him in the loo, and he was just standing there, and he goes, "She's a goddamn whore." And I thought, "Oh my God." And I thought, "Is she?" Anyway, he said, "We got to get out of here." So we literally ran to the car, got in the car. I did a sort of Starsky and Hutch skid turn. And as we did, she ran out of the hotel screaming at us. And we sort of left. And we thought, I mean, in a sense, I think that it was nervous laughter, but we were roaring with laughter. And then we found somewhere else to have something to eat in the next town. And then I suddenly thought, what if she goes to the police and say we raped her or something? And Mark said, "Oh, don't be so stupid. Of course she's not going to do that." And about 2 minutes later, he said, "Yeah, what if she did?" I said, "I think we need to get into Austria." So we made it to the Austrian border and got through the border control. And I remember getting out of my car and kissing the ground. And I'm sure we were being completely overdramatic, but that was quite an experience.
I thought you were going to say in about 2 minutes later, a police car pulled up. I had probably one of the... I went to Budapest in 1995, actually, and it still felt very new after, you know, the changes and everything. There was still bullet holes in the walls. And obviously, they're probably still there now because they stay there. But I was at Brighton University at the time at the art college, and we went on a, you know, sort of art tour by coach as well. Days and days, such a long way away, isn't it? And I had one of the most politically wonderful moments of my life there. I wasn't really into politics at the time. I developed that later, but we met these group of art students, these really like handsome men with like shaggy hair and thin and those sort of great cheekbones that they have in Hungary, and these big eyes. And they took us to this cafe, which was everything was covered in lace, and there was someone serving playing the piano in the corner, and they started having all these great political debates, which I couldn't really keep up with, but I nodded along and got very drunk. And then afterwards they took us to this jazz club. I want to call it a jazz club, it's a bar, but they were playing avant-garde jazz, and it was the most hideous music I've ever heard in my life. They were just playing jazz instruments at different times, you know, and everything, nothing was, and everyone's sitting there like stroking their chin, and I'm looking around thinking, oh my God. But it was actually very, very exciting. You know, it felt like you were part of, it almost felt like you were part of the resistance, you know, although obviously there was nothing to resist by that point, but it was just really a very sort of a very evocative moment, you know, very, but the music was absolutely shit.
Sounds like a fast show sketch.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. It was something out of a sketch. It was right. What have I got on my list now?
I wish I hadn't written a list now.
No, I love your list. No, because we never do this. So I love to, you know, let's mix up the format. It's really good. And also, you know, it means that I get your best stories. So you were in Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2010. Both countries I've never been to, actually.
Well, I went to Armenia. I think it was 2008. And then Azerbaijan was actually, which is only a couple of years ago, I think. But of course, those are two countries that literally hate each other's guts. And if you have an Armenian stamp in your passport, you don't get to go to Azerbaijan. It's that bad. Armenia was fantastic. I got invited to go there by the John Smith Institute. They were doing a lot of work on enhancing democracy. So I had to go and do some talks. And I was very, I'd become quite well known as a blogger in the sort of 20 in the first 10 years of the century. So I really went to talk to them about media, blogging, freedom of speech, all that sort of thing. It was a really brilliant experience, I have to say. And then Azerbaijan, I got invited to chair a conference by the... I can't even remember what they called that now. It's basically a conservative grouping in the European Parliament. And they'd got loads of MEPs and politicians, and there were a lot of British people there as well. And I'd never been to Azerbaijan, so I thought, well, why not? And it was the most fascinating country, the cleanest country I think I've ever seen, which you in that part of the world, you don't expect everything to be pristine, but it absolutely was the most fantastic hotel, I think, well, almost the best hotel I've ever stayed in, a massive, massive room. And I had to chair this conference for 2 days, which was very easy to do. And then they sort of put on lots of entertainment in the evening. One thing I did notice, though, there were policemen on virtually every street corner. I mean, it was really, I mean, I hesitate to call it a police state, but shall we say there wasn't a lot of flexibility, I think, on the part of the state regarding their people. But it was a great experience.
It's probably why it's so clean when you go somewhere like Singapore, you know, which has that police state-esque, you know, situation, and it's absolutely spotless. But it also made me think of Cuba, where you have the police there, but the police and the tourist police are there to kind of stop you from mingling with the locals and answering too many questions.
I would hate that. I mean, even in Russia, which was the most policed visit I think I've ever been on, you could still talk to people and get a bit of an idea of their lives. What's the point of going to a country if you can't mix with the local people?
Yeah, I don't know what Cuba's like. I went when Fidel was still, you know, alive and in charge. And I wanted to have political conversations with people, but they would have them, but they were very, you know, sort of glancing around furtively and whispering, which is interesting in itself. You know, I have no idea what it's like now. I'd love to go back, actually. It's a beautiful place. I'm coming to the end of my list, the list that you're hating now. I'm enjoying the list. I really am. The gay hotel on the Florida Keys. Now, that sounds like my sort of party. Absolutely sounds like my sort of thing.
Well, I've been to Florida quite a few times, but I'd never been to the Florida Keys. So I drove down from Miami and found this hotel. I can't remember what it was called. And it turned out to be a gay hotel. Now, I'd never stayed in a gay hotel before, but I thought, oh, this could be fun. So, and it was one of those places, now how can I put this, where at night, not all of the doors were shut. And you would sort of find people, shall we say, entering your room to check you out to see if they wanted to go any further. And it was, and in the swimming pool area, I mean, that was sort of basically anything goes. I mean, you'd sort of, you'd be on your sun lounger having a snooze and you'd open your eye and shall we say you got an eyeful. So it was one of those type of hotels, which I had never experienced before. But shall we say, I'm not going to tell you everything that happened.
It sounds good. And it sounds like if you haven't experienced one of those before, it's a good sort of place to experience once. I spent a lot of time in Brighton and I'm moving back there at the end of the summer. And there are rumouredly hotels like that. But whenever I go out with like my gay friends to clubs and everything, you know, you're there for a certain amount of time. And then after a while, it's like, you know, it's time for you to go now. we're going on, you know, where the real party starts. Have you ever, as a gay man, have you ever had any difficulties in with travel and, you know, any prejudices when you've been? Because there are countries where, you know, you can't really go or can't go freely.
No, not at all. I mean, it's not something, I mean, I don't think if I walk down a street, I'm not sure that anyone would think, oh, he's gay. I don't sort of fit into any of the particular stereotypes, I don't think. And I'm trying to think, I can't think of anywhere that I've been.
No, you're right, because all my gay friends, again, this is a Brighton thing, but all my gay friends are left-leaning, vegetarian, So, you know, when I was only living in Brighton, I thought they all went hand in hand. I couldn't believe when I got out, you know, into other places that were like, you know, right-leaning gay men who yeah, ate meat, you know.
Because, like, you know, people on the right can be gay. People on the right
it's not, it's
can
bad.
Be it's, vegans. I mean, why they would be, I don't know, but there we are.
So those things always went hand in hand with me. Lastly, on the list of joy, you're absolutely rubbish in airports, apparently. The airport experience is going to change dramatically now. I'm going to be on a plane soon. In fact, by the time this is out, I'll probably have had my airport experience, so I can report back. But yeah, what's your haplessness in airports about?
I'm just terrible. I have to get there hours before I need to, just to make sure that I do get there, because I'm always afraid that I'm not going to get there. Once in Miami airport, I lost my boarding pass, got a replacement, and then lost that as well. In Maine, I was getting a connection to Florida, and I was in the lounge for the particular airline and missed the connection. So I had to stay at Maine airport for another day before I could then fly down the next day. I'm just hopeless in an airport. I have to keep checking the boards to make sure that I'm not late to get to the gate. As soon as the gate opens, I'm there, so nothing bad can happen once I get to the gate. I quite like airports, bizarrely. I don't know why. So if I go to America, I will probably get to Heathrow 5 hours before the flight goes. Just to make sure that I'm there.
And have you ever missed a flight?
I've never missed a flight to America. I think the only one I missed was that one within America.
I've missed them before, and I'm finding as I get older, I'm a little bit more less gung ho, and I'm a little bit nervous. But I'm flying with two very young children at the moment, and that like an assault course.
And I would be the one sat next to you on the plane. I attract babies on planes like bees to a honeypot. My nieces used to call me Uncle Herod, so you can see how good I am with children.
Uncle Herod, I love it. Before I ask you my last question, is there anything else I've missed? Any standout stories? You seem to go to the States a lot. What's up with America?
I do. I just love America. Washington is sort of my ancestral home in a way. It's got everything a capital city can give me. And as I say, I used to go two or three times a year. For the last 10 years since I've been doing LBC, I've been out there a couple of times to do like Trump's inauguration, Obama's second election. But most of my friends have moved out of Washington now, and Washington is not what it used to be. A lot of the places that I used to go are no longer there, which is always a disappointment when I go back. And I haven't been there for nearly 4 years now, so I don't know when I'll go back. The only other one that I'd particularly mention is the only African country I've ever been to is Rwanda. And I went there. Do you remember David Cameron took a load of Conservatives to do social action projects there in 2007? I went to cover that as a journalist. And so we got put up in the most marvellous hotel in Kigali, literally one of the best I've ever stayed in. While they all had to stay in these sort of shacks, we got taken all around to all the sort of genocide memorials. It was the most amazing experience. So I remember taking my camera woman, Alice, out to a village. We just got a car and drove out. When we got out of the car, we were literally surrounded by all of these little children and their parents. And it was as if they'd never seen a white person before. And that was the only time, they were kind of just fascinated by us, but it's the only time in my life where I've kind of felt a real fish out of water. And I felt like, I remember when I was a Tory candidate in 2004, being in Cromer on the North Norfolk coast, and everyone was staring at this black man walking down the high street because they'd never seen one before. Not in Cromer. It was shocking in a sense, but they weren't being racist. It was just something different. And if you see something different, you stare. And that's what was happening in this little village in the middle of Rwanda. And we were only there about 5 days, but it was somewhere I thought I really want to come back here for a much longer time.
I had a similar experience with Ethiopia recently, but I don't want to lump African countries. You know, Africa is a continent rather than, you know, a country, as everyone says when people go, oh, have you been to Africa? But, you know, a lot of those African countries that you don't normally go to on a holiday, if you get an opportunity to go there, and I was in Ethiopia for work recently, it's just you know, it was just stunning and so green. You know, you have these images of Ethiopia as, you know, the drought, and which actually was more of a political famine rather than a drought, sorry. Mm. It's just so green and beautiful and wonderful, and nowhere I would have thought of, you know, going for a couple of weeks, but yeah, really lovely. I can't even tell this story, and I'm so embarrassed. You know, you're talking about the people that were the black man being stared at in Norfolk. I did something similar to someone on the Brexit night vote, and I am very much a Ramona, I'll admit it. When the Brexit vote happened and it turned out some people chose to leave the EU, I was in the centre of London in Soho that night, getting very drunk with my friends and crying about the whole affair. And I mean, I'm from a mixed race family as well, so don't ask me why we did this, but out of nowhere came this couple, a black man and a white woman, and they looked really trendy and like super cool and everything. And it's almost like the crowd parted to let them through. And I remember, like, I think I went up to them and said something. I was so drunk. I think I said something like, "Well done," or "This is what it should be about," in my shocked European, you know, state. And, you know, it's like I was so othering them. And, you know, it was just awful, and I'm so embarrassed even to admit it. Like I said, I'm, you know, from a mixed race family myself, this is not something new, but I was almost like those people in Norfolk staring at this black guy and his wife.
You didn't sort of slur in your drunken state, "I bloody love you, you're my best mate."
I think that is exactly what happened, and I'm so ashamed. If they're out there, if they happen to be listening, I'm so ashamed. Right, I'm going to ask you my last question after that embarrassing admittance, is that the right word?
Yeah, admission.
Admission, yeah. Admittance is something completely different, isn't it? Yeah. A lockdown has melted my brain a little bit. So I will ask you my last question. And my last question is always about music, because I think that music and travel often go very, very much hand in hand. And if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, it doesn't have to be a good memory, it just has to be a story, what would that song be and why?
This is, you're going to throw up when I say this.
I like it.
My favourite song of all time is by Cliff Richard, and it's called "Miss You Nights," and it's the most balletic ballad you've ever heard. It's basically just him singing with piano music, and it's one of his most famous songs, but it didn't actually do very well in the charts. And I can the reason I've chosen that is because I've been to Australia a couple of times, and I went to stay on the Northern Territory's coast, about 300 miles from Darwin, literally in the middle of nowhere. It's crocodile country, but there's this little enclave of houses that presumably quite rich people own. And I can just remember sitting on the veranda of this house every night thinking, this is the most special place that I've ever been to, because it was just hundreds of miles from anywhere. Dirt tracks you had to drive to get to it. There were no roads. And it was just a place where you could really get away from it all. You couldn't get Twitter. You couldn't get any internet. There's hardly a phone signal either. And it was just bliss. And I just remember playing that song on my iPod at that point. And yeah, it was just perfect.
You know, I'm not going to throw up at all. I think that's one of the most beautiful songs. And I'd forgotten that song, actually, because I don't often listen to Cliff Richard. And it's
anybody
song.
Listening, just because it's Cliff Richard, don't let that put you off. Go and look at it on YouTube. And if you don't, it is, to me, the perfect ballad. And I do like a piano-based ballad.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast. Tell us again the name and where we can find... Well, I know where we can find the music, because everyone knows where to find books these days. But what is the latest?
Well, it's called "Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Shout Less, Listen More." It's $12.99 in hardback, and it's out on the 6th of August. And a lot of people like audiobooks nowadays, and it is available as an audiobook. I read it myself, and I've got quite a soporific voice. So if you find it hard to sleep, buy the audiobook and just listen to my dulcet tones and you'll go to sleep.
I'm sure it'd be too thrilling to go to sleep too. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Coming up, we have some brilliant guests for you, including Laura Hamilton from A Place in the Sun, Lloyd Grossman and his new book about Rome, the wonderful poet Lem Cisse, and multi-million selling author Justin Somper. See you soon.